It's a tremendous chus to introduce the Maggid Shir for multiple reasons. Rabbi Wall is well known throughout the country, throughout the world, for giving shurim, for being a Morah D'Asra, and now being a Baal Bus in our community. And we have the privilege of hearing Gishir in the Beis Medrash every once in a while whenever he's free and not traveling. The summer learning program in Bnei Shurin is a very challenging program. And one is to get people who are here during the summer to give shurim. And when I approached Rabbi Wall, to my surprise, he allocated, took out from his time, which is very, very limited, to give shurim and akihila. A tremendous hakaras atov, because anybody who knows Rabbi Wall knows the schedule. He really is on the road most of the time, and he's giving shurim throughout the country. And as the except as the director of the OU and the person who really is a tremendous influence on the American Jewish community and worldwide now, it's a tremendous bliss for me to introduce Rabbi Wall. The Shurim during the summer program is for given in the ability that we should all pray that Chaim Yisachar ben Chaim Mushkat should have a Refuah Shleima, and for all the Chole Yisrael and the Cholim of our community. Kavod Gadol, Rabbi Wall.
Henry, thank you very much, and thank you for organizing the program. What we're going to do over the course of the next four Thursday nights, tonight, the next three nights, is take a look and analyze four different kinos, four different aspects of the Tisha B'Av experience that really are an opportunity for us to look at ourselves as a people, how we view mourning, how we view different phenomena. And let's just dive in, and then we'll see it in retrospect. But if I could use an example of what we're going to speak about this evening. A year before Schindler's List came out, there was a poll done in America, and they asked Americans, so we're talking about primarily Protestants, Catholics, we're talking about different minorities, do you believe that 6 million, no, I think that's the way it was phrased, do you believe that 6 million Jews were killed in the Holocaust? And the number was, I think, 64% of Americans believed it. That means over one-third of Americans did not believe that there were 6 million Jews killed in the Holocaust. Now, a year later, independent of this survey, Steven Spielberg comes out with Schindler's List. Spielberg had a love, had a real sensitivity and a feeling for this story. He thought it would work as a movie. But it actually was only the third script in terms of the screenwriters. They showed him two different scripts and he turned it down. He said, no, it's got to be tweaked. That's not going to grab people. And then when he saw the third script, he said, this will work. Spent a tremendous amount of money. Went to Poland, filmed it. And look, the end we know. The impact that Schindler's List had on the world. And remember, we're talking about a Hollywood production, even if it was filmed not in Southern California, but filmed in Eastern Europe. What happens? A year after Schindler's List, the exact same question is asked of Americans. Do you believe that 6 million Jews were annihilated in the Holocaust? 93% of Americans said yes. Can you explain that? How in a gap of 3 to 4 years, it went from 64% to 93%? Very simple. People cannot relate to, people cannot fathom. Intellectually, they can perceive it, but emotionally and psychologically, people cannot relate to huge numbers. What was Schindler's List? It was a story. Now, the character that Ben Kingsley played, Stern, he actually was a composite character between someone who worked for Schindler and the Jew who was essentially the right-hand man of Gott, of the horrific, of the monster who ran the Plaszow camp, the SS commandant. In fact, that Jew, after the liberation, settled in Poland. He just passed away about a year ago. It was a fascinating obituary in the New York Times. In fact, Alan Pines, who's a son-in-law of one of the Schindler Juden, Mr. Pantier. Many of you know Mr. Pantier here from New Jersey. They came here with nothing, and they literally developed the whole real estate empire. They supported Oskar Schindler, they supported his wife over the years, And this person, who after the liberation stayed, lived out his whole life in Poland until about 92 years, he was one of the two people that the composite character of Sherman was. The world related to Ben Kingsley, to Stern. We're talking about an actor. We're talking about a Hollywood creation. But psychologically, they could relate to it. And they could relate to the Holocaust. And it became real. And it became impactful, not just on Jews, on all of America. Look at the Holocaust. What is the work that people associate with the Holocaust? So, thanks to Oprah, it's Elie Wiesel's Night. But after the Bible, the book that has sold more copies than any other book on the face of the earth is The Diary of Anne Frank, the story of a Dutch adolescent young woman, a Dutch adolescent Jewish woman, because it's the story of one human being. That phenomena that we see through the Diary of Anne Frank, that phenomena that we see through the character of Stern in Schindler's List, is something that the Medrash, in the Medrash we're going to quote in just a moment, in the time of Rabbi Akiva, picked up on. And it's something that the Kalir, of course, is the one, Rabbi Elazar HaKalir, contemporary of the Gaonim, lived in Israel, northern Israel. He's the one that literally takes our hand. And he holds our hand and escorts us through the experience of Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av wouldn't be Tisha B'Av without the Kalir. By the way, for that matter, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur wouldn't be Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur without the Piyutim of the Kalir. But the Kalir saw that same methodology, and he was astute psychologically to that same point. What am I referring to? The Medrash in Parshas Noach and Bereishis Rabbah talks about the fact that Rabbi Akiva went on a fundraising expedition to a community called Ginzak. We're not sure where Ginzak is. We speculate it's in North Africa. What was Rabbi Akiva traveling to North Africa raising funds for? Our speculation is the Bar Kokhba revolt. After Hadrian, Andar Yavish, the infamous Caesar, after he'd made promises to the Jews to ease up and abet the oppression that the Roman proconsuls were engaging in, his own Roman people turn on him and say, who are you? You're a Philo-Semite? Who are you, with the Jews or are you with your own people? So what did he do? He had to backtrack. And he really put the screws on the Jewish people. He made it unbearable, intolerable to live. And of course, we started a revolt. And that revolt that we call the Bar Kokhba Rebellion was huge. But it means the following. We had to fund an army. We had to mint our own coins, create our own currency. Many of you have been to Israel, you see the Bar Kokhba coins. It's not easy to run a government. Ask the people in Greece or Ireland today, right? It's not simple to run a government. And Rabbi Akiva went on a fundraising expedition to North Africa. So what did he do when he met with the people? It says, he would tell them the story of the Dora Mabel. He would tell them this generation, the tsars of that generation, and it didn't move them. And he was a great orator. So what did he do? He started to speak about the personal tragedy of Eov, of Job. Had these beautiful young daughters that we're going to speak about in a few moments in this kina. Had wonderful young boys. Nebuch, a father has to bury all of his children. What we just experienced in Borough Park just yesterday. You know, people who were at the funeral came back traumatized. You know, we think about it, B'nai Yeshuin, right? All the kids that come for the learning program, right? The Manny Fried learning program, the kids in the youth programs, kids going playing ball. Well, Eov didn't bury one child. Eov had to bury all of his children. He was a self-made man. He developed a financial empire. And all of it comes crashing down on him. He was a healthy, aesthetically like his children, a very good-looking person. People looked up to him. His body is riddled with disease and pain and suffering. And it says, Rabbi Akiva, when he went into the tsaris that Eov suffered, and what happened to Eov, the people were moved not only to tears, the people were moved to contribute, to donate. Why? Because you can't relate to the destruction of a generation. Psychologically, it's very difficult. But one human being's story, one man or one woman's story, that's something we can relate to. We can associate with, we can empathize. And then only then do we start to have an appreciation for the depth, for the magnitude of the calamity. That methodology, if you go through the kinos, you'll see it in three places. One is the story of Yoshiyahu HaMelech that we actually will address in it. I'm not sure if it's next week or in 2 weeks. The second is Arzei HaLevanon, the story of the 10 martyrs. And the third is a kina not written by the Khalil. The author of this kina is Yechiel. We speculate, we can't prove it. It's the great Rabbi Yechiel of Paris. Rabbi Yechiel of Paris, the great Rishon who was forced in 1240 to engage Pope Gregory IX and King Louis IX of France listened to him, and they forced the Jews to have a debate regarding the Talmud, that the Talmud was an anti-Christian, was anti the Gospels, anti the carpenter of Nazareth. And this Rabbi Yechiel of Paris, who was a leader of the Ashkenazi Jewish world, he was the Rebbe of the Maharam of Rottenburg. In fact, in the aftermath of these forced debates, when the 24 cartloads of all the manuscripts of the Talmud in France were taken and burned by the Place de Concours, what happened? At that point in time, many historians feel that was the death of French Jewry. The funeral of French Jewry may have taken place 5-6 decades later with expulsions, but that was a death knell. So, this Rabbi Yechiel of Paris, if that's who the author of this is the author of this kina. Now, this kina is extremely powerful. Because unlike the Asara Haruge Malchus, the 21st kina, unlike the story of the death of Yoshiyahu HaMelech, the 11th kina, the people we're going to be speaking about in this kina were not famous, did not have a profound impact on the Jewish world. In this kina, speaks to us, the orphan generation, the generation after the Churban, after the Shoah. Let's start, and we'll see where we're going with this kina. If you don't mind opening up. It says, Navi Chatasi Hishmima, because of my sin embodying the Jewish people, the sin of the nation, the Mikdash was destroyed. We're 438, 439. The Dimasi, Alechiyi Azrima, that my tears stroll like Niagara Falls. They just come rushing down my cheeks. V'yom zeh, on this day of Tisha B'Av, nihi nihi ya'arima, I will raise my voice in crying, v'ahima miyamim yamima. What is v'ahima miyamim yamima? So the Rav said, here, Rabbi Soloveitchik said, I'll mourn from year to year. There's a concept that we have that the Rambam articulates. The Rambam says the following, that when it comes to mourning, it says, on the one hand, anyone who does not mourn the loss of someone, that person is an achzari. Achzari doesn't literally mean cruel. Achzari is from the two terms, achzar. You know, it's someone else. They dissociate themselves from death. They dissociate themselves from pain, from suffering. The person doesn't have the ability to empathize. And there's something wrong and there's something very unhealthy. But it says that a person, call him Miss Abel, Yoser Midai, anyone who mourns excessively, Hareza Tipesh. Hareza Tipesh does not mean the person is an idiot. It means the person emotionally is foolish. Emotionally, there's something that's unhealthy. Why? The Rambam says, because it's Minhagol Sha'olam, the nature of our existence as human beings, we were all born to die. We're born, whether you live 20 years, 40 years, 60, 80, 100 years, it's not a very significant amount of time historically. And our existence, by definition, is a futile one. It's a limited one. It's a finite existence. The point is what? We were all born to die. And the Rambam says that someone who can't get over a loss, of course there's a time to cry, there's a time to mourn. That's a shiva, a shloshim. There's a period of the first year. But life is a galgal hachozer. Right? It's a cycle. It's the wheel that turns. And you have to grow. And you have to move forward. And you have to take the sense of sadness and remorse and use it as an experience to build and to grow. Not to be in a state of depression. Not to be in a state of paralysis. But the Rav says there is one exception to that rule, and he explains it. It's not an exception, it's a different category. What's that? The Rav said that anyone who dies al kiddush Hashem, anyone who is killed or who dies for the sanctification of God's name, the Rav says that's not minhago sha'olam. Minhago sha'olam means that this organism that we call the human being, Homo sapien, is a limited organism. It has a limited shelf life. But that someone is butchered or killed or slaughtered because they represent God's system, because they're a Jew, because they're an Israeli, because they represent a certain destiny, a certain legacy, not because they die of natural means, but because they're slaughtered or massacred. He says, that's not minhag sha'olam. And he says, that we never get over. We never get over that. And the Rav said the following. What happens categorically? This is not, the Rav didn't create this. This is something that he learned from his Zaydi Reb Chaim. Essentially, the way the Soloveitchik family saw all Avelis, there are four categories. The four categories we're familiar with. Aninus, between the death and the funeral. Shiva. Shloshim. And Yud Beis Chodesh. And unlike other Achronim, when it comes to Sfira, the 3 weeks, the Gimavachim, what do they say? Well, there's Nihugei Avelis. You don't do this, and you abstain from that. That's how Rav Moshe learns, that's how most Achronim learn. That's not how the Soloveitchiks learn. They said that by definition, all Avelis, all mourning has to fit into one of those four categories. Chazal defined for us structures and categories. You know what's happening on Tisha B'Av when we read the Kinos? We're attending a funeral. It's Aninus. It's the Aninus before, so to speak, before the burial. The Hespedim, and the role of the Hesped is what? To evoke a sense of deprivation. When you go to a funeral, a eulogy is not a fair translation of a Hesped. A eulogy in America is really, it's a Mishaberach. Right? It's not the Dean Martin roast, in a funny sense, it's a Mishaberach. It's a tribute. A tribute to a great man, a great woman. You know, they had an amazing golf game, you know, oh, you should have seen them on the green, yeah, that kind of a thing. A Hesped is just the opposite. A Hesped is trying to convey what we as a community have lost. There's a gaping hole, there's a vacuum in our existence because of the state of deprivation that we're in. That's what a Hesped is. It's meant to evoke tears. They say the great German Rabbanim, when they give a Hesped, the whole room, and Germans, you know, we're not the softest people on the face of the earth. The whole room would be crying. That's what's happening here. The Kinos are the Hespedim for the tragedies that have befallen the Jewish people throughout the millennia. And the point that the Rav is saying, that this Rabbi Yechiel of Paris is saying, Vahima mi yamin yamima, as opposed to a normal death where you move on and you go forward, and the pain turns into gratitude, into memories of fondness, not so here. The wound is opened up again. The hurt, those raw nerves, are re-exposed. And we go back each and every year, we go back to the funeral, and we relive it. We go back to a state of aninus, which is the worst. What do we say about aninus? There's no comfort, there's no consolation. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, B'shar shemesim buta lefana. In a state of aninus, before the burial, you can't, by definition, you can't comfort or console someone. And that's the experience we have in Tisha B'Av. So what is it? What particular story are we going to talk about? He goes on. Avel Lev wasn't just conduct of mourning. What does Avel Lev mean? It's a pain. It's a wrench. It's a broken heart. V'nichum chadal chadol. It is absolutely impossible to give nichum. I refuse to receive any consolation or comfort over this. Mikol ke'ev siri nivdal badol. This pain is unique. It is different than any other pain. Over who? Al beinu bas Rebbe Yishmael Kohen Gadol. It's the story of the son and daughter of the high priest, Rebbe Yishmael. What's the story here? You know the story of Rebbe Yishmael from the 21st Kina. You know that story from Eila Ezkara on Yom Kippur. He was this outstanding, stunning, gorgeous. He wasn't just the great scholar, which he was. He was the religious leader, the head of the whole educational branch of the Jewish people. But he was stunning. So stunning that the daughter of the Roman proconsul said, don't just kill him. Take his face, and let's mount it on a butt. Let's create like a mannequin out of it. So I can always look at the most gorgeous, the most stunning human being on the face of the earth. And we know about how they literally peeled his skin off. And when you kill the Gadol Hador, when you kill the religious leader of the people, what does that do to the people? We know about their father's death. So what happened to the kids? You know what happened to the kids? What happened to tens of thousands of others? Now, you and I, we've all been to Israel, to Jerusalem. You're familiar with the Jaffa Gate. There's the Damascus Gate, what we call in Hebrew Shar Shechem, and there's Shar Yafo. Shar Shechem, if you follow it, is a path going north. It'll take you up to Syria. It'll take you through Highway 60, through the valley that goes through the mountain range, which we call Hare HaMelech, first the end of the Judean mountain range, then it becomes the Samarian mountain range. And then when you get to Shechem, it's almost like, take a look at this diagram. You're going up Highway 60, and then it veers this way. It's what we call the Via Maris. It's the way to traverse the mountains into Mesopotamia. That's if you take the Shar Shechem, the Damascus Gate. What happens if you leave the Ir Atika, and in those days it was the city of Jerusalem? You take Shar Yafo. Shar Yafo doesn't go north. Where does it go? West. Why does it go to Yafo? Because Jaffa was the great port city. Now, keep in mind, you and I do not think of Jaffa as a great port city. Basically, the best you can do is get into a small fishing boat there. Right? It's not particularly deep water. When you think of a deep water port, you think about Haifa. Remember when David Ben-Gurion came to America? They started selling the Israel bonds. Do you know what the first project of Israel bonds was? And it's been since that time, it works 24/7. The dredging of the Haifa port. The dredging of the sand. Because what happens is, when there's a collusion, when the one weather pattern of over the water of the Mediterranean, when it hits dry land, what it does is it forces, in a certain way, it forces something to take place where you have a buildup of sand. The Jaffa port today is a huge buildup of sand. That's what Haifa would look like. But because 24/7, this original Israel bond project of the dredging of the Haifa port, so it's a deep sea port. It's a deep water port. That's what Jaffa used to be like. In the story of Yonah that we read on Yom Kippur, that's what the Jaffa port used to be like. So what happens? The Romans would take, along that western road, the western highway, thousands, if not tens of thousands, of Jewish captives from Jerusalem, put them in ships at the Jaffa port, ship them across the Mediterranean, and sell them as slaves. And it would be a source of income for the empire. Now, just to give you an example of what happened, think for a second about the most basic principle in economics. What's the first principle we teach in economics? The supply and demand curve. What happens with the supply and demand curve when you have the same amount of demand, but a huge increase in supply? What does that do to the price? Shrinks the price. It crashes the price. That's what happened to the Roman slave market. Because there were an influx of thousands, if not tens of thousands, of Jewish slaves, it shrunk the price. And in fact, after the Churban, we spent the next decade and a half, engaging in pidyon shvuyim, literally buying up each other and freeing our brothers and sisters. So who are two of the slaves that get sold? The survivors of the Kohen Gadol, the son and daughter of Rabbi Yishmael. They're taken on ships to Rome. Zichron yekod bilvavi asima. Their memory, it burns, the raging fire that I always place in my heart. I can never forget what happened to them. Vahima miyamim yamima. This day, every year, I go back and I mourn and I cry what happened to them. What happened? Es nishku. At the time that they were abducted and captured by the Roman soldiers, and they were taken to the Jaffa port and sold and bought there, v'nafu l'shnei adonim. Two different masters. You know, individual bought, one bought the daughter, one bought the son. It turned out that they were neighbors. They lived one next door to the other. They started bragging to each other. They started bragging about what? The great nitzia, the great bargain that they found. The first one said, you know what I have from the Zionist captives? Shavisi shikha levusha shanim. Shikha is a term we use for a servant. I've got for myself what's levushat shanim, clothed in scarlet. I mean, she radiates, gorgeous. She radiates. Kalavana bezivu klastar panim. It's like the moon. Think about it when you go camping. Last week we were in Alaska, so you get a nice, if the sky happens to be clear at night, what do? You see this white moon, this beaming, so to speak. It's reflecting the sun's light. It lights up the whole sky. That's what her face was like. With a toar kitsia v'yamima. And what are her looks like? Who are kitsia v'yamima? We mentioned that. These are the two daughters of Job, of Eov, who died a young death. V'ahima miyamim yamima. Re'ehu sifer lo b'kiflayim. Yeah, neighbor. You're bragging? I can brag to you twice fold. You think you got a deal? You think you have the most gorgeous, amazing thing? Let me tell you. You know what I've got from the captives of Jerusalem? From the slave captives? Shavisi Eved Yefeinayin. I've got a servant. His eyes. By the way, I grew up on a cattle farm. We buy and sell livestock. One of the things we did before we ever bought an animal is you always look in the eyes. You get an insight into the health of the animal, into the function and abilities of the animal. So he says, look at the eyes on this guy. Kashemesh, you said that she was radiated like the moon? This one radiates like the sun. The Tukfo, not just any sun, but those of you who remember Gary Cooper, High Noon, but the sun at high noon. The Sahar Eis Zamana Hishrima. Vahima Miyamim Yamima. And again, the author says, over this conversation, I mourned. Because keep in mind, as we turn the page, what would have happened to this young man and young woman? What would have and should have happened? He might have been the next Gadol Hador. He probably would have been the next Kohen Gadol. He for sure probably would have had a seat on the Sanhedrin HaGadol. What would have been her story? Maybe she would have married the next Nasi, the descendant of King David, right? The head of the Sanhedrin. If not, she would have married a scholar. They would have mentored the next generation. They would have been the leaders of the next generation. They would have had children. They would have continued our Mesorah. That's the story that should have happened. I want to tell you a story that before we continue in the Kina, it's a story of a man that I had the great honor of knowing. And I'm going to leave his name out because, for the sake maybe that I don't know that he would want his name to be mentioned. He was an Alexander Chassid. His father was in the lumber business in Poland, a huge lumber business. They cut down forests, they owned tens of thousands of acres, and they would ship the lumber all over Europe. Much of that lumber was exported outside of Europe. And he was the only boy in the family. His siblings were sisters. And he was raised to be a Talmud Chacham. His job was going to be to sit and learn. And he loved to learn. And the father was going to support him. And he was, you have to understand, especially think about a European mentality, he was the apple of the eye of the parents because he would carry on the name. He would be the legacy of that family. And everything changed in 1939. Obviously, their assets were taken. His parents were killed. His sisters were killed. He survives. He survives. Not as the budding Talmud Chacham, the heir to a fortune. Not as someone looked upon, that would be an influential member of the... And remember, in Europe, you had the Gera Hasidim and the Alexander Hasidim, a branch of Alexander with the Amshinova Hasidim. These were the heart and soul of what we call Congress Poland, the heart of Poland. Galicia had different groups of Hasidim. Litha was primarily Misnagdim, and Eastern Poland was primarily Misnagdim. But just to give you an example, Lodz would only choose a Misnagdish rabbi for the city of Lodz, because the population of the Jews of Lodz, which made up 40% of that city, were either Gera Hasidim or Alexander Hasidim. That one shouldn't have the upper hand on the other. They made an agreement amongst themselves. We're always going to take a Misnagid as the rub, so that way, you know, if it's a Gera Chassid or if it's an Alexander Chassid, it's not fair to the other group. What happened? This whole world was destroyed. How many Alexander Chassidim are there today left in the face of the earth? Do you know how many hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of Alexander Chassidim existed before 1939? All gone. This man, so for Parnassa, he worked as a painter, worked for others, tried to make it on his own, didn't make it. He's a nice man, but he's a Nebuch. He was a ghost of himself. He was a pale shadow of himself, because that's not what he was meant to be. That's not what he was raised to be. He lived. He survived, but not who he should have been or what he could have been. And he never came to grips with losing his family, losing what he could have been and should have been. He was an eighth of what the man that he should have been. And I want to tell you something before we get in, because that's the point of this kina. We're going to get into it now. Do you know today that over one-third of the Holocaust survivors are under the poverty level? You've all heard about the Claims Conference. We have statistics. The Israeli government has statistics on the economic status of senior citizens, but particularly the Holocaust survivors. Over one-third are under the poverty level here, Israel, Eastern Europe. See, we all know the stories of the families that rebuild, of the families that come here, and they're going to sanctify the memory of their loved ones. And they're going to do what? They're going to build yeshivas. They're going to build up new children and grandchildren. They're going to build a malucha and a dynasty. And we all tell those stories, because there's not one school that doesn't have their name on it. There's not one shul that doesn't have their name on it. And there's not one of our communities that hasn't been built by survivors who came here with absolutely nothing, and rebuilt their world, and rebuilt their lives, and we pay tribute to them. But there's a group that we don't talk about. The son and daughter of Rabbi Yishmael. And there was a famous book, and that's what we named today's shir. It's called The Seventh Million. Not the 6 million that Hitler and the Ukrainians and Lithuanians and Polish Catholics killed. It's the seventh. It's the eighth, it's the 9 million that survived, that didn't survive. It's the stories we don't tell. About how they were haunted by nightmares. About how they led a depressed life. About how they have sick children who today are in their 40s and 50s. Because they were sick and disturbed. Not because they did anything wrong, but because they were the korbanos of our oppressors. Who led dysfunctional lives, who've translated that dysfunction into their children, into their grandchildren, now as the third generation. What about those? Those are the living korbanos. That's the story of the son and daughter of Rabbi Yishmael, Kohen Gadol. And for them we mourn. There's no matzeva for them. There's no eternal flame for them. Because they lived. 20, 40, many of them are alive today. But they didn't live. It's a dysfunctional life. It's a depressed life. It's a tragic life. And that's the story of this kina. Let's continue reading. So the Lord said, Bo nezavgeim, let's breed them. Unechalka bintayim. You know what? I mean, see, you have to understand where I grew up. This is wrenching to read this line. This is the way we treat cows and bulls.
A cow that's got a bad spine, we get her the semen from a bull with a good spine. A cow that's got really great milk production, but not enough high enough percentage of milk fat, we get a bull whose sperm produces offspring that produce good milk fat. This is the way you talk about animals. This is what we talk about secretariat, you know, the children and grandchildren of secretariat. This is the science of breeding. It's not what we talk about with human beings. But you understand? These budding young Jews, these tzaddikim, they were turned into horses and bulls. Let's breed them and we'll split up the kids. Bivlados kemo kochei shamayim. Oh, you kid, they'll produce children that radiate like the stars of the heaven. So the author says, the shame of those, even hear this, tzal naznayim. You ever have, where your ears ring, where you hear this horrific sound and your ears are ringing and you can't sleep, you can't handle it? He says, that's what's happening. So you can hear language like this, my ears are ringing. L'zecher zos es madai afrima. To eat, when this is even mentioned, to even discuss this, I want to tear kriya. Madai means my clothing, afrima. I'll rip open my clothing, I'll tear kriya again. And the Rav, when he taught this kima, he said this is his whole notion, that you relive the death, you relive the mourning. When someone dies al kiddush Hashem, you re-experience the loss. It means tearing kriya again. When the two of them together, the two Roman members of the aristocracy agreed upon this, what do? They put him in a room to breed him. Now remember, there's no light, there's no electricity, so the two of them are in a dark room. The masters are outside, and what? The son and daughter, not knowing that it's each other, not realizing each other, they're sitting there crying. Ad boker. They don't touch each other. She doesn't approach him, he doesn't approach her. The chiyasam lohit mima. Their cry could not be silenced, that this is what was become of them. They're being treated like animals used for breeding purposes. Dahima miyam miyamima. Zegispod, bikod levad yimseh. So the son of Rabbi Yishmael, mourning himself with a heart on fire. Nin Aaron, the descendant of Aaron. Ech l'shivcha yihinose. There's all kinds of mitzvahs that we know from Parshas Emor about the stringency, special kedusha that a kohen has to have in terms of who they can have relations with, in terms of who they can marry, because there's a greater sense of responsibility. If they're meant to be role models and teachers, then they have to be perfected in the realm of the instinctual. And the most acute aspect of the instinctual life is the sexual. And the whole series of who they can have relations with, who they can marry, who they can't. Vehi gamhi tiyarel besigra shosa. Not only did he mourn, she was sitting there. Bas Yocheved, the daughter of Yocheved. What's the role of Yocheved? Yocheved is going to be producing the Gedolei Hador, the future of the Jewish people. Producing a Moshe, an Aaron, a Miriam. What's she now going to produce? She's going to produce the child of a slave? She's going to produce the child of what? An African? A North African? A Mesopotamian? Some slave that they've gathered up from throughout the empire? Eich le'evet tinosei. How can the daughter of Yocheved be married off to an Evet? Meaning here it doesn't mean literally an Evet, it means someone not of the proper genealogy. Oi, woe, kizos gazar omer va'oseh. How could it be that this is, that the Almighty has decreed this? Not only has he decreed it, he's implemented this decree, this horrific decree. Lizos yivku, osh ksil v'chima. What are osh ksil v'chima? Orion, Pleiades, the constellations. Now this is a theme that comes up again and again in the Kinos. It's not just the Jewish people who are in mourning. The universe mourns. The cosmos mourn. What does that mean, the cosmos mourn? Because this is a corruption. This is a perversion of the way the universe was meant to run. The whole purpose of the universe is for the benefit of humanity. And the role of the Jewish people is to transform humanity. And when this takes place, it's not just that we, the Jews, cry and mourn. the whole cosmos, the whole basis of existence is corrupted and perverted, and it mourns. That's the line, the Zos Yivku Ash Ksil Bechina, Orion Pleiades, Vahima Miyamin Yamina. Or Boker. What happened? The sun cracks through, it's the light of the morning. Ze Ezek Kihikiru. They recognize each other. Hoyachi. Hoyachos. Oh my God, it's my brother. Oh my, it's my sister, Hibiru. V'nischabeku yachad v'nischabaru. They embrace each other. Ad yotza nishmosim v'nishima. Until they die, their last breath. Vahima miyamin yamima. Now how to explain that? Either literally, they died of exhaustion. See, it doesn't have to be taken literally, they died that moment. You could take it literally, but I don't. I think the idea basically is we all know of people who die of depression. I mean, we all know of a case of couples that have been married for years and then one spouse dies and the other spouse loses the desire and the strength to live. This young man and young woman who are physically at probably the strength of, you know, think about, you know, the energy, the greatest energy anybody has is their late teens, their early 20s. What happened here? They died of depression. They lost the will to live. They lost the will to keep going. We couldn't fathom an existence like this. And it was an existence, not that they didn't commit suicide. It's an existence that's not worth living. And this is what I'm saying we had. That we don't talk about. The 7th million. The 8th million. It is for tragedies like this that Jeremiah cries out in horror. He says the kino's over. Again, this decree of what happened to these, it wasn't just these two. These two young kids, sorry, they're not young kids, young adults, they embody the generation who lost its youth. They may have survived. They may not have been slaughtered by Titus and the Roman legions, but they lost their youth. I mean, you read Elie Wiesel's Night. You read some of the works of Elie Wiesel later on in retrospect. How many people do we know? They never lived, they never had a childhood. They never had an adolescence. It was wrenched from them. And this fire, this pain, it wrenches, it rages within my heart. Over the son and daughter of the Kohen Gadol. I can never get over this. Every year we go back, and every year we mourn this. This is not a historical work. It is. This is a historical event. This happened, we're talking about the 8th decade of the 1st century. That's when this happened. Probably 72, 73, 71, somewhere in that time frame. But this is something that's contemporary. This is contemporary. Yonah Baumol died this year. You know who Yonah Baumol was? Zachary Baumol's father. Many of you probably met him, heard him speak. He said, describing his life with Miriam, he says, you don't understand what it's like. He says, every time the phone rings, what's going through our mind, is that the call that our son is dead? But at least they're going to get back his body? Is that a call that our son's alive, that our son's going to come home? And then when we get to the phone, and it's not our son, or it's not news or word about our son. Just the emotional roller coaster, the pain we feel. Did Yonah Baumol live another 25 years after his son was abducted by the Hezbollah? Yes. Did Miriam Baumol, she's still alive? Would you call that a life? Or would you call that a ghost? A body haunted by a ghost? That's what happens. That's the seventh million. That's the story of the son and daughter of Rabbi Yishmael. We don't just mourn those individuals, those great, glorious individuals, those people who were leaders of the Jewish people, who had impact upon hundreds and thousands. Yes, we do. That's the 21st kina. That's the 11th kina. But there's a principle we have. Every Jew is a sacred Torah. The ones who are not scholars. The ones who we never hear about. The ones whose future was wrenched from them. Whose innocence was taken. Who live a depressed, tragic life that is a pale shadow of what they could have been. That's the purpose of this kina. And in the embodiment of this young man and this young woman, the son and daughter of Rabbi Yishmael Kohen Gadol, we also mourn all those who survived physically, but who didn't survive. Who never survived emotionally, never survived spiritually. The walking dead. The bodies that were haunted by ghosts. And we mourn them on Tisha B'Av as well. And that's this king. Next week, we're going to speak about, I believe next week's topic is, the man who could have saved the world from the Churban, could have saved Jewish history. In the great tragic loss of Yoshiyahu, Melech Yoshiyahu, what led to his loss, what the ramifications of his loss were, and why specifically the Yirmiyahu singled him out as an individual to write a whole chapter of Eicha about. And why the Kalir, and we'll talk a little bit, we didn't get into it this evening because this was not the Kalir's kina, but who and what the Kalir is and what role he plays. We'll speak about that individual as well next week. Thank you.